We'll have a great week.
Today is Monday, October the 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Bunganyi in Washington. French President Emmanuel Macron denounced as an unforgivable crime a bloody crackdown on Algerian protesters by police in Paris 60 years ago. But he stopped short of offering a full apology for the French government's role in the massacre.
The Algerian War of Independence was really into its final phase. It lasted until 1962. But for those Algerians who were living in France, they were subject to very strict curfews, in fact.
And a man is being held by British police for the fatal stabbing of a lawmaker. The United Nations is warning that the fight against world hunger is being lost. It is calling for action to improve food security for the world's most vulnerable people.
The pandemic has left an additional 140 million people unable to access the food they need.
And last week, a military court in Ouagadougou began the long-awaited trial of 14 men, including the former president Blaise Compaoré, accused in the assassination of Burkina Faso's leader Thomas Sankara 34 years ago. So why did it take this long? And what will justice look like if the man accused of being the mastermind of the crime is not in court? We'll have this story and many more coming up right here on International Edition. Stay tuned. And for our top story, President Joe Biden paid tribute Saturday at the U.S. Capitol to fallen police officers and honored those who fought off the January 6th insurrection at that very site. AP correspondent Julie Walker reports.
Biden spoke at the annual National Police Officers Memorial Service to remember the 491 officers who died in the line of duty in 2019 and 2020.
Your loss is also America's loss.
The president stood where the violent mob tried to block his own ascension and singled out Capitol Police.
Because of these men and women, we averted a catastrophe. But their heroism came at a cost.
Biden pointed out 150 officers were injured and five died in the attack's aftermath. He also pushed for reforms that include more resources for police, not less.
We expect everything of you, and it's beyond the capacity of anyone to meet the total expectations. Being a cop today is one hell of a lot harder than it's ever been.
I'm Julie Walker.
A man is being held by British police for the fatal stabbing of lawmaker David Amis. AP correspondent Karen Chamas reports.
The suspect's father has told British media that he was shocked and traumatized by his son's arrest as police continued questioning the suspect under terrorism laws. British authorities have not released the name of the suspect in the killing. However, British media have named him as Ali Harbi Ali, the son of a former advisor to Somalia's prime minister. Amis, a long-serving lawmaker, was stabbed multiple times during a regular meeting with his constituents at a church in Leigh-on-Sea, a town 40 miles east of London. Many in his constituency, like local resident Les Thorrington, are mourning his loss.
Lost a great man, and I don't think you'll ever replace him again.
Local Member of Parliament Andrew Rossendale says Amis's killing is a worrying sign for British politicians.
Someone can go on social media, find out where your surgery is and turn up and cause you harm.
Karen Chamas, London.
And British Home Secretary Priti Patel says a police investigation is underway into the killing of the lawmaker who was stabbed in a small English town east of London.
There are obviously discussions around MP security too. And when we think of David himself, man of the people, he was killed doing a job that he loved, serving his own constituents as an elected democratic member. We cannot be cowed by any individual or any motivation, people with motives, to stop us from functioning, to serve our elected democracy. So on that basis, we have measures in place. We'll continue to review and strengthen measures, and rightly so.
British Home Secretary Priti Patel. Pope Francis has denounced recent attacks around the world, calling for an end to violence. AP's Karen Chalmers has more.
Last week, many attacks took place, such as in Norway, Afghanistan and England. I express my closeness to the victims' families and beg you all to please abandon the path of violence. The Pope spoke to an audience in St. Peter's Square for his customary Sunday remarks and blessings delivered from a window of the Apostolic Palace. In Norway, a bow and arrow attack claimed 5 lives, and a suicide bombing carried out by the Islamic State in Afghanistan killed over 45 people. In England, a British lawmaker who was meeting at a church with some of his constituents was fatally stabbed. The pontiff described violence as a defeat for everyone and said, "Let's remember that violence generates violence." I'm Karen Chamas. Voice of
America! A former top aide to former President Donald Trump faces the real possibility of criminal charges for refusing a congressional subpoena. AP's Tim McGuire reports.
The House committee investigating the January 6th assault on the Capitol by supporters of former President Donald Trump has scheduled a vote Tuesday on bringing criminal contempt charges against former Trump advisor Steve Bannon for refusing to comply with a subpoena. Reporters asked President Biden about Bannon.
I hope that the committee goes after them and holds them accountable.
Should they be prosecuted by the Justice Department?
I do, yes.
If the committee and then the full House agree, the charges will be sent to the Justice Department, which has the final say in any prosecution. Bannon's lawyer says he's complying with Trump's claim of executive privilege, despite his not working for Trump or his administration at the time of the attack. Tim McGuire, Washington.
And the U.S. government will pay the families of Afghan victims of a drone strike in August. AP's Jennifer King reports.
The U.S. says it will pay relatives of Afghans killed in a drone strike in August. Pentagon spokesman John Kirby said in a statement Friday, the U.S. Defense Department will offer condolence payments to relatives of 10 people killed in Afghanistan in an errant U.S. drone strike in Kabul. On August 29th, a Hellfire missile struck a car that had just pulled into a driveway of a family compound. 10 members of the family, including 7 children, were killed. The U.S. Central Command called the strike a tragic mistake. Kirby says they're also working with the State Department to help surviving family members relocate to the United States. The U.S. military originally said it had targeted an Islamic State group's facilitator, but the Associated Press and other news organizations quickly reported that the driver of the targeted vehicle was a longtime employee at a humanitarian organization. Jennifer King, Washington.
The United Nations Refugee Agency says that the first of 3 emergency airlifts of relief supplies for Afghanistan that landed in Tamiz, Uzbekistan Friday will be followed by 2 more flights this week. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
With Afghan airports closed to commercial traffic, the UN Refugee Agency has diverted flights to the Uzbekistan border town of Termiz, which will act as the epicenter of a massive Afghan relief operation. UNHCR spokesman Baba Baluch says the 3 planes together are delivering more than 100 metric tons of shelter materials, blankets, plastic sheeting, and other supplies to help Afghans withstand the rigors of winter. He says the supplies will be trucked from Termiz to Mazar-e-Sharif in northern Afghanistan and distributed to 126,000 people in the country. He says more supplies will be needed as his agency hopes to aid some 500,000 Afghans.
We need Kabul to resume activities as soon as possible. I mean, so many things depend on it. And also we hope to fly in special flights into Kabul as well with our relief items and bringing in more aid. So if supplies are available anywhere, we'll be moving them to Afghanistan.
The United Nations estimates 18 million people, half of Afghanistan's population, needs humanitarian aid. More than 3.5 million Afghans are internally displaced, including more than 500,000 newly displaced this year. Baluch says people are living on a knife's edge. A few days ago, he says, he visited a distribution center 15 to 20 kilometers outside Kabul, where he witnessed the desperation of people lining up for aid.
When I was standing there, we saw an old mother collapsing in front of our eyes. So when colleagues attended to her, the reason was she hasn't eaten for days. And she's the one who's heading a household because what has happened to her? You have grandfathers, you have children, you have little girls who should be in school and they're queuing up over there, being in the aid distribution queue.
Since the Taliban took control of Afghanistan in mid-August, girls have not been allowed to go to school and women have been prohibited from working. Baluch says it is a race against time to provide aid to millions of Afghans before winter sets in and access to many will be cut off. He warns the blistering cold weather can kill anyone caught out in the cold without any help. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And marking World Food Day, the United Nations is warning the fight against world hunger is being lost and it's calling for action to improve food security for the world's most vulnerable people. Lisa Schlein joins us again with this report.
In his message marking World Food Day, United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres calls for vigorous action and investments in strengthening local food systems. His message comes as nearly a billion people globally do not have enough food. The United Nations warns hunger is on the rise, driven globally by conflict, displacement, climate change, and the economic impacts of COVID-19. Among those most at risk, it says, are refugees and those forcibly displaced within their countries by conflict. The UN acknowledges its goal of eliminating world hunger by 2030 will likely not be met. Guterres says almost 40% of the world's population, 3 billion people, cannot afford a healthy diet. That, he says, is causing undernourishment in the form of both malnutrition and obesity to proliferate globally.
The pandemic has left an additional 140 million people unable to access the food they need. At the same time, the way we produce, consume, and waste food is taking a heavy toll on our planet. It is putting historic pressure on our natural resources, climate and natural environment, and costing us trillions of dollars a year.
World Food Day marks the anniversary of the founding of the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization, which was established on October 16, 1945, in Quebec, Canada. FAO Senior Program Officer in Geneva, Patrick Jacquesson, says more than 150 countries hold special events every year in observance of the day. He says this year's theme calls for the transformation of agri-food systems to provide enough affordable and nutritious food to people everywhere.
With an ever-growing population expected to reach 10 billion by 2050, we need to feed the world and nurture the planet. It is not just about responding to emergencies, it is about building longer-term resilience and changing how we produce and consume food.
The FAO recommends development of diverse agricultural systems, which it says are more adaptable to climate change and other shocks. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jackson Bunganyi. French President Emmanuel Macron denounced as an unforgivable crime a bloody crackdown on Algerian protesters by police in Paris 60 years ago. Analysts say that even though Macron stopped short of offering a full apology, this so far is the strongest recognition by a French president of the massacre in which over 200 Algerian demonstrators were killed by French police and over 12,000 arrested. Linda Gradstein joins me from Paris to speak on the significance of this event in French political history and how it affects the current discourse on French-Algerian relations.
The Algerian War of Independence was really into its final phase. It lasted until 1962. But for those Algerians who were living in France, they were subject to very strict curfews, in fact. And it was in October 1961 that members of the Algerian National Liberation Front, based here in Paris, called on Algerians to go out and demonstrate because they felt it was unfair of the Paris police to have them under curfew. It was a very strict curfew. It was a curfew against anyone who was French Algerian, anyone who was considered Algerian Muslim. They had to stay home. And on that day, or on those few days, in fact, some 20 to 30,000 Algerians turned up and demonstrated. Now, around 12,000 of those demonstrators were taken into custody, Some died, some were beaten, some were kept in custody for a very long period of time. Exact numbers are not unknown. The Elysee Palace, the official office of the French president's office, said that several dozen died when they were thrown into the River Seine. Other people, particularly Algerian academics, say between 100 and 200 people died in that weekend. So no exact number as to how many died, but certainly it was a large number. And you know, perhaps no one will ever know. At the time, right, the only indication people got that people had been thrown into the river was a few days later, bodies started turning up, washed up on the shores of the River Seine in central Paris.
Right. And it's possible that some of that information might be known by the government, but it's still under wraps, because I've seen some researchers who say that during their research that they have been kind of hampered, or some of the information around it was not made available to them. Now, President Macron is the first French leader to attend this commemoration. Why did it take this long for the French government to acknowledge this massacre and that has been called a state crime by many? And does this amount to an official apology?
This does not amount to an official apology at all. In fact, although President Emmanuel Macron did go to an area of the River Seine over the weekend and he laid flowers, he stopped well short of an official apology. In fact, he said that what the Paris police did was inexcusable, unforgivable. But that was as far as he went. And a lot of people have been saying it's time for him to go further. President Macron is the first French president to be born after the Algerian War of Independence. He's a president who has continually talked about the need for France to recognize what happened during that colonial period. But he did not apologize. And in fact, one of the criticisms that's been made of him this weekend is that he blamed this entire event on the Paris police. He didn't mention that the Paris police quite possibly operated under the orders of the Prime Minister or the Interior Minister or even the French president of the day.
So what does this timing mean for the French-Algerian relations? That there's clearly tension between the two countries based on France's decision to reduce the number of visas for Algerian citizens traveling to France. Remember Macron speaking disparagingly about Algeria in context of its, what they call colonial revisionism, I guess. How does this commemoration affect the relationship between these two countries?
It doesn't go far enough for it to have any positive effect. If you look at what the French have been receiving in terms of protests just in the last 2 days, you can see that it isn't going to go anywhere at all. The Algerian authorities have said that they expected it to be declared a massacre, what happened in Paris in 1961. The president of the association called In the Name of Memory, whose father was actually one of the demonstrators, he has also been calling for this to be called a massacre, saying people were assaulted, that it's not enough to say that it was unforgivable or inexcusable. So it's not going to go very far on the Algerian side. And when you think that at least 7 million people living in France are either Algerians or descendants of Algerians who moved here or descendants of settlers, this isn't going to go far enough. It possibly went as far as he could have gone, given that there is a French presidential election in just under 6 months' time, given that he has to be very careful not to alienate the right wing of his supporters who still feel that not enough was done within the French academic sphere to acknowledge what they went through in Algeria. So you've got these two competing sides. You've got the Algerians saying, let's look at what the French did in Algeria and how they treated Algerians in France. And then you've got some of the French soldiers and their families who served in Algeria who feel that they were badly treated, history has forgotten them, and in lots of ways they're treated very unkindly by history.
That was Linda Gratstein. She was speaking to me from Paris in France. And in other news, as many as 17 American Christian missionaries and their families, including children, were kidnapped this weekend by gang members in Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince. Media reports said that the kidnappings happened after the missionaries left an orphanage in the Caribbean nation. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. And while there, check out our other programs, including podcasts of shows like Upfront. We have a TV show, Africa 54, broadcasting each day on African continent. And remember to connect with us on our YouTube channel. Search for VOA Africa. You're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jackson Bunganyi. Now, even the most prolific songwriters can get writer's block. A team of researchers at Waterloo University in Ontario, Canada, say that they have developed a new system that uses artificial intelligence to provide the help songwriters may need to write their lyrics. Rick Pantaleo joins us in this episode of Science in a Minute.
This is Science in a Minute.
Even the most prolific songwriters can get severe writer's block when it comes to developing lyrics for a song. A team of researchers from Waterloo University in Ontario, Canada, say they have developed a new system that uses artificial intelligence to provide the help songwriters may need to write their lyrics. Called Lyric Jam, the creators of the system say it relies on different characteristics of the instrumental music fed into it, like its rhythm, chord progressions, and instrumentation. From these aspects of a song's music, the system creates lyrical lines that reflect its mood and emotions. Lyric Jam's creators point out that their system doesn't actually write songs, but it provides creative inspiration that the composer can use in penning a song. If you're a songwriter and want to try out Lyric Jam, go to the system's website, lyricjam.ai. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
International Edition continues. The government of Burundi recently received its first batch of COVID-19 vaccine. It was the only East African country yet to receive the vaccines. And Moses Habyarimana joins us with this report from Arusha.
The first batch of COVID-19 vaccine is expected to be deployed in Burundi later today, according to the country's Minister of Health. 500,000 doses of Sinopharm vaccine is expected to be delivered today at Bujumbura International Airport from China. Burundi was the only East African country whose citizens were yet to be vaccinated against the pandemic, despite the rising cases of COVID-19 in the country. Tadendi Kumana is a Burundi's health minister. He says that there are vaccines expected to arrive, and he wants all citizens to know that his ministry implements the directives of the president with the priority of protecting citizens. He says residents of Bujumbura who are traveling within the country will from next month require the test of COVID-19. Burundi last month suspended all social events and ceremonies during the weekdays due to the increased number of COVID-19 cases in the country. Nightclubs and karaoke spots were closed due to the pandemic. Despite the surge of COVID-19 cases in the country, the government had rejected the vaccine, claiming that it was yet to be approved by the World Health Organization. Ines Takaya is a Burundian citizen reacting on the deployment of the coronavirus vaccine.
I highly appreciate the decision of availing COVID vaccines in Burundi, as now people who are willingly to take it will have the chance to get it without traveling to other countries. Also, I hope that the spread will lower now that many people will have the opportunity to get the vaccine.
Since the pandemic was first recorded in Burundi in March last year, more than 80,000 people tested for coronavirus. Among them, 19,441 people tested positive for the virus, while 19,076 people recovered, and 14 of them died, according to the Burundi government. Achel Niyongere is one of the citizens in Bujumbura. He says that as a citizen, he welcomes the decision of the deployment of the vaccine and that he is ready to be vaccinated, and that the government announced that it is done voluntarily. Achel says he thinks the move will help to curb the spread of the COVID-19. The African Union and the World Bank are expected to deploy another batch of COVID-19 vaccine later this month. Despite Burundi government's move to allow the deployment of COVID-19 vaccines in the country, the government said that any citizen who volunteers to be vaccinated should do it on his or her own risk. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Arusha, Tanzania.
And this December, Gambians will go to the polls in what has been described as one of the most important elections in a generation. It is the first election post Yahya Jammeh, whose brutal dictatorship closed democratic space in the Gambia and suppressed all forms of political dissent. Sene Marena is the editor of Alkamba Times, a Gambian digital news platform. He tells me that this weekend's protests are testament to the role and power of the Gambia's civil society in holding their government to account for promises made when incumbent President Adama Barrow took power in 2017.
So the protest yesterday was meant to call on the government, you know, to for victims to, you know, let them know, you know, how serious they are about the implementation, because they believe that with the recent political happening, you know, there is a lack of political commitment from the government to implement the Truth Commission recommendation. But can barely 24 hours after the announcement of the protest, the government through the Ministry of Justice also issue a press statement for the first time, you know, reassuring victims, Gambians and international community that government is fully committed to the implementation of the TRRC report, which is expected to be submitted to the president not later than next month.
So basically, government responded in a positive way.
Yeah, to the surprise of many activists, you know, partners and stakeholders in the transitional justice process. They issue a very strong statement, you know, saying that even they are planning to establish a reparation fund that will be taken to the National Assembly for the victims. So there was a dramatic U-turn from the government with regard to its commitment to the transitional justice processes, including the Truth Commission.
You know, Jammeh had brutally suppressed the civil society during his over 20 years in power. Mm-hmm. How active are the civil society groups in Gambia right now, and how have they evolved during this first post-Jammeh administration?
Yeah, thank you. That's a very fundamental question. As you rightly mentioned, civil society, like the media, were very oppressed during Jammeh's rule. But since the coming of the Barrow-led coalition government, there has been a significant steps taken by the civil society. They have reorganized, re-energized themselves, you know, to take up their rightful places. And this has really, you know, had impact in the current democratic process, because when this thing happened, they do organize protests. They do organize press conferences. They even petition the executive and even, you know, go to National Assembly to make sure that lawmakers do the right thing for the country. So the civil society in the country have been very proactive during these past 4 years, unlike Jammeh's 22 years, where they were seriously affected by their operations been seriously hampered by Jammeh's dictatorial tendencies. So unlike before, now they are very active. You know, they have been calling on protests. They have been conducting press conferences, petitioning the government on issues they think should be done. You know, also making sure that the promises made by the coalition government are fulfilled. So they have been doing very well. And yesterday's protest is, you know, it's a clear commitment of the steps taken by the civil society groups in the Gambia.
Sene Marena is the editor-in-chief of Alkamba Times, a Gambian digital news platform. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Remember to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a great week ahead.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
The World Health Organization and Africa Center for Disease Control say we all can help fight the global pandemic by frequently washing our hands with soap and water or using hand sanitizers. For more information on protecting yourself and others, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa Center for Disease Control. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest on COVID-19.